Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. If you watch late 1950s and early 1960s TV series, you'll probably see at least one episode in which the husband tells the wife he absolutely forbids her to get a job because he's the breadwinner in the family. Well, the history of working women and their depiction in American media is a little more complicated than that, and the popular magazines women read through the decades shed light on this aspect of society in both advertising and articles. The new book, Business Girls and Two Job Wives, Emerging Media Stereotypes of Employed Women, chronicles how magazines portrayed women who worked outside the home from 1918 to 1941. Its author is Dr. Jane Marcellus, an associate professor in the School of Journalism at MTSU. Jane, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Jenna.
I'm really
glad to be here.
I like this book, too. I like how it's seemingly comprehensive and holistic it is, in addition to, you know, it having its academic P's and Q's
right.
in order. What magazines are we talking about? The time period was before our time, but I can remember some magazines that have endured, like McCall's, Ladies Home Journal, Cosmopolitan before Helen Gurley Brown. But for purposes of this study, you actually took into consideration, I understand, a wider range of magazines than just those that targeted homemaking women, right?
Right, absolutely. I tried to look at a broad kind of cross-section of magazines that would reach a number of different audiences. For example, certainly Ladies Home Journal, McCall's, there used to be Women's Home Companion, which was very much like Ladies Home Journal, but also Forbes, Fortune, which were business magazines, and in the 20s and 30s, primarily business men's magazines. And it was a very gendered business world where men had certain jobs, women had certain jobs. So I looked at how they were portrayed. Also just general magazines. One of the most popular magazines that was before my time or yours was the American Magazine, which was kind of an everybody's magazine for everybody. Saturday Evening Post, Collier's, Liberty, just a number of them.
Were the working women who worked in the sweatshops and factories on the assembly lines oftentimes with their kids working right beside them before child labor laws were passed, have access to magazines like this? Or are we talking mostly about middle-class women?
I really am talking about both. It's not either or, it's really both and. And I worried less about the women as readers of the magazine than how women were portrayed. So one of the really interesting things that I found is that social class for women has traditionally been determined by women's husbands or fathers, because that was in traditional before women had jobs, when women didn't have jobs, that was who earned the money. So when women went into the workplace, that was still somewhat true. So what I do in the book is I identify a number of patterns used to portray employed women, but those patterns tend to cut across social classes. For example, I have one pattern called the exception, you know, women who were kind of in non-traditional jobs, even for women, and that could include physicians and lawyers. It could also include women who worked as engineers or laboring jobs. There's one about a woman who's paving streets, you know. So the class issues, the otherness of the portrayals cross what we would think of as middle class, working class kind of lines in some interesting ways.
I'm intrigued that you found one with a woman paving streets.
Yeah.
Highly unusual for that time period, a profession for a woman.
Well, yes.
What, did it treat it in a satirical way? Or
The name of the article, which was from the 1920s American Magazine, was called A Girl Who Bosses a Paving Job. And yes, it did make fun of her. And it one of the things that representations of employed women tend to do then and now is treat them as exceptions, and in doing that, kind of reaffirm their femininity. So in this particular article, it was saying, yes, look at this girl who's out there bossing a paving job, but it emphasized that she had all these men working for her, and that she would cook them meals and take care of them and be sort of maternal and wife-like to them. So those representations tend to reinforce traditional femininity, even while they're saying, look at this woman doing a quote-unquote non-traditional job.
You get the idea that they're trying to say, by depicting a woman in a quote-unquote non-traditional role, that she can do this work despite the fact that she's a woman. Not because of it, or having utterly no relevance to her sexuality whatsoever. But in spite of her femininity, she can achieve what men have achieved.
Yes, it's interesting because it's both in spite of her femininity, and yet the femininity is sort of reinforced, or readers are reassured that even though she's doing this very odd, quote-unquote odd thing, she is still, you know, feminine. There was one depiction of an attorney where it showed her in a kitchen with a cake, and it said, you know, even though she was some top attorney in New York and in some legal firm, that she had that she could still bake a cake, you know, so she was still a womanly woman.
Mm-hmm. And all those decades later, when the issue of Hillary Clinton arose as to using her maiden name as to whether she could make blueberry muffins, we wonder how much or how little we've learned.
Absolutely. One of the points in the book is that we have I call it a symbolic echo of media stereotypes, that media producers still draw on these familiar patterns, I think because they are familiar, because in the deadline pressures of a newsroom, you tend to go for what's familiar because they resonate with readers, because they still sell ads.
Or just because we as a society sometimes can be rather intellectually lazy and we don't want to do the hard work of ferreting out the more complicated nuances of our human existence.
I would agree. Absolutely.
if you want to sell products, if you've got advertising in these magazines, you don't depict the people you want to buy the products in an unflattering light. So how do the advertisers in the magazines see their larger audience in an age before focus groups and all the other means of breaking down demographics? Did they have their specific parameters about what they thought? The woman I want to buy this product is such and such and so, and that's that. Or how did they decide to depict the women in the ads using whatever product, whether it was a typewriter or a food product of some kind or a cleaning device, whatever it was?
Right. Actually, the 1920s were a particularly interesting time for advertising, because before around that time, if you had an ad in a magazine, it would have lots and lots of written copy and lots of information about the product itself. So, for example, if it was Ivory soap, it would tell you all about the soap itself, what you could clean with it, its virtues as a soap, so that you would know about the product. After the 20s, or during the 20s, advertisers started using tableau, or sort of idealized pictures of people who were happy in some way. They were with their families, or they were, they were on vacation, or they were, doing any number of things where they looked, and this is how advertising works now, where they looked happy and successful.
This product will make you happy.
Yes, absolutely. So the idea was to tie the product to the happiness. So that's how it's all over the place. I mean, that's how ads work now. So you have, beer is sold with a picture of a guy on a beach with beautiful women in bikinis. So drink this beer and you'll get beautiful women with bikinis. And even though we know that doesn't, it's not realistic.
Yeah.
It's our kind of fantasy dream world of advertising. Well, that started in the 20s. So what happened for women and employed women was mostly the women who were targeted and who were depicted were the Mrs. Consumer, the housewives, the domestic woman in a domestic setting.
Mommy bathing her baby or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. And so, well, I mean, actually at this time you had lots and lots of women going into the workplace. So there's kind of a contradiction here.
Mm-hmm.
There were employed women, though, in advertisements, especially in Forbes and Fortune, which were targeted to men, but they were also men who were buying office products. So lots and lots of depictions of secretaries. And because my mother was a secretary and I grew up kind of in this world, I was especially, that's actually my favorite part of writing this book, was all these depictions of secretaries. And what happened when I was initially working on the book is I would, I would sit down with all these magazines and I would find the advertisements, you know, going through volumes and volumes of, say, Forbes, and finding depictions of secretaries, and I would mark it, and then I would stand at the Xerox machine and Xerox all of these. Well, at the Xerox, it was actually at the Xerox machine.
Which is another office machine used by a secretary.
Exactly, but yeah, I was at the time, you know, doing research.
Right.
But standing there Xeroxing, I started just noticing that all these depictions of secretaries, they tended to be turned around so that we saw groups of them and we saw their backs. We didn't see their faces. We didn't see them in a way we could interact with them. We saw them almost as faceless objects.
They were one of the pieces of office equipment as opposed to the workers. They were
exactly.
They were just as much
exactly.
a piece of the equipment as their typewriter was.
Actually, a name for female secretaries was typewriter. So the typewriter was the machine, but it was also the woman.
Yeah.
So the woman was a typewriter. You had a job as a typewriter.
Mm.
And so in these depictions of secretaries, you know, they were idealized, they were beautiful, they were feminine, but they either looked at their machine that they were working at, their typewriter, or sometimes their adding machine or some other machines, or they would look at their bosses, you know, but they never looked at each other. They never looked at the reader. The only exception was one of the typewriter companies had a line of ads called the Debutantes of Modern Business set of advertisements. And these were very beautiful. They were pastel. And they had a picture of a secretary, almost like a picture that you would have in a newspaper of a woman kind of coming out as a debutante. So they were debutantes of modern business. They were in the office to get a husband, preferably the boss or the boss's son. So it's a very sexualized world.
Yeah.
And a very, obviously, of course, horribly sexist, but...
Yeah, pre-code movies did the same thing. The woman who slept her way to the top. Barbara Stanwyck did one like that and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, but actually that's interesting because a lot of magazine depictions, especially short stories and articles, they wouldn't actually go through with it. It wasn't that sort of blatant. Mm-hmm. It was the sort of hint of it. So there's one short story called... It's my favorite, called Office Baby, where this woman is a secretary. She's married. She has, you know, her boss didn't want her to get married, but she did anyway. And then when she became pregnant, he was afraid she would be fired, which you could do legally at that time. He could have fired her for being married. This is quite common, and people don't realize that.
Pregnancy was treated as though it were a disease or a deformity instead of, they were punishing the human race for reproducing itself, basically.
Well, yes, and also I think punishing her for trying to do both, for being a two-job wife, mm-hmm. you know. So we still have these patterns in our culture. We call them different things. It's called maternal profiling, mm-hmm. What in the 20s and 30s was called the two-job wife.
You could also call that part of the symbolic echo, because it still resonates today with some people who don't think that a woman with small children can be good and competent and devoted to her job and be a good mother at the
Absolutely.
Same time.
Absolutely, and we don't say that about men.
Yeah.
So certainly we have, now we call it superwoman, but it's much the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So...
I like the picture, especially where you showed the woman looking down at her typewriter with her boss standing over her. And in the caption, you indicate that she couldn't look out the window because there was no window. So the only thing that is subordinate to the woman is her equipment. And she is obviously subordinate to the male supervisor who is standing over her. And like, you don't have to be a director or a film critic mm-hmm. to get the symbolism, right? It's pretty obvious.
Right. Actually, the office window... You have to remember that in the 20s and 30s, this was the kind of new world of the businessman whose masculinity and whose sort of office power, symbols of that were actually having an office window from which he could sort of survey his vista of success, I think, is a phrase that one person I quote.
His domain, his territory.
Domain, exactly. And so he could look out the window. He could look out over, you know, from the top of the skyscraper, out over this domain, and she could not.
Mm. That's so symbolic. With any media, there's this chicken and egg question. Did the social mores influence the media, or did the media influence the social mores?
Right. That's a great question.
Did you get an impression when looking, researching these magazines one way or another? Or is it so symbiotic that it's just not a black and white issue?
Both and.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely symbiotic. One of the theorists that I study, Stuart Hall, says that there's a circuit of culture, sort of media create culture, culture creates media, and that it is a chicken and egg and sort of a non-answerable question. But I think in the case of employed women, that it was very much driven by the political economy of the magazine business, because advertisers wanted to portray women as staying at home, as consumers. This is the kind of the early consumer culture is on the rise. And so if women were housewives and consumers, then that drove the advertising, which drove the magazine. So that all worked together. And so women's reality was often invisible, especially during the Depression, which is a fairly understudied time in terms of employed women. Actually, this whole period is understudied in terms of, you know, in terms of employed women. People say to me all the time, oh, when women went to work in the 1970s, or when women went to work, you know, with Rosie the Riveter in the 1940s, and that is simply not true.
Whether they think that, you know, the 20s and 30s, women were just more or less dormant, and then the war kicked in, and then, boom, all of a sudden women went to work. But there were women working
right
in the 20s and 30s.
Absolutely, that's a myth. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I was blessed with a mother who was a bit older when she had me. She was nearing 40. And so she had been a very young woman at the end of the interwar years, and she would talk about these times. And so it was like what I was hearing, the kind of myths I was hearing, and what my mother would just casually mention or outright tell me about didn't match. And so I started wanting, just out of my own personal curiosity and what my mother had told me, to kind of find out what had been going on. So that's really, you know, how the book started. Certainly there was, women's realities were very much made invisible by the predominance of depictions in the media of women as only kind of the June Cleaver stereotype, who mm-hmm. very much was a stereotype herself. You know, if you think about June Cleaver, the character on Leave It to Beaver, her mother could have been, you know, a working woman in the 20s. If you think about kind of, you know, when she would have been born and, you know, like that. So, there's really this sort of, you know, forgotten workforce or invisible history that we have around women's employment. And what a controversy it was. I mean, it was terribly controversial. So all the issues that we've talked about with Hillary Clinton and with women in the workplace and all of this, we've had this discussion in America before, and it has just gone under the rug.
We can't get over it.
We can't get over the myth. We keep repeating the myths as though they are reality, and it's just not like that.
They are social constructions. They're not things put into our DNA. They're not organic in any way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was curious about the Great Depression because you would think that with 25% of the workforce out of work and people absolutely destitute with nothing, zero, zilch, that a family would be grateful for any member of the family who could get out there and find gainful employment regardless of what it is, just please bring income into the household.
Yes.
Did that loosen things up for women at all?
That's a really interesting question, and it's another question that has a both and answer. You're absolutely right in your logic, and that was people's reality. What happened in the Depression was that women could get jobs when men could not get jobs. So women could get jobs as waitresses, as secretaries, as, you know, women working in a department store that men would not do because it often threatened their masculinity. At the same time, there was this idea in the Depression, because people hated women in the workplace. They especially hated business women or professional women. Women who had to work because of poverty or because they had to support children or they were widowed or whatever.
Or just because they were single and didn't have any other means of support except their own ingenuity and talent.
Right. They were more accepted, but women who were professional were not accepted. And so what happened with the 1932 Federal Economy Act, which actually FDR signed into law, was that there was this stipulation in the federal government that if there was both members of a couple, of a married couple, were employed by the federal government, one of them had to quit. It did not come out and say that it had to be the woman, but women were legally paid less, as they are now, but they were legally paid less. And, you know, before the 1963 Equal Pay Act. And so what happened is a lot of women lost their jobs. This federal law was used as a model even in private business. So the idea that married women needed to leave the workplace forced a lot of women out. At the same time, a lot of women were the family breadwinner, because they could get waitressing jobs or they could get some kind of low-paying job that exploited them terribly. It didn't pay them very well, but it kept food on the table and it kept a roof over a lot of families' heads. And yet they were vilified because they were supposedly, you know, in the sort of mythology of the times, taking jobs from men. So it was a lose-lose situation in the worst way.
Even though they were not taking a job from a man, literally, because they were doing a kind of work that a man would not want to do because it would make him look feminine in his eyes.
Exactly. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. Was there anything in the magazines that indicated to you that secretaries or other women who worked in offices were threats or made the housewife at home feel threatened? Because there was a movie in the 30s with Clark Gable and Myrna Loy called Wife Versus Secretary.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Jean Harlow was supposed threat their marriage.
There was also The Office Wife, which was both a book and a movie. I think in the Clark Gable Jean Harlow movie, The secretary and Clark Gable, or Jean Harlow and Clark Gable, weren't actually involved. They were working on some business deal, but it looked like they were, you know, involved. But yes, that was the threat of the office wife was there was sort of the office wife and the home wife. And the phrase office wife was used. I mean, and it meant a secretary. And one of the most fascinating symbolic echoes I've seen is the recurrence of that idea or that phrase, even though it's not quite used in the same way. The phrase of the office wife, it was in a Maureen Dowd column when Harriet Myers was nominated to the Supreme Court, and of course she didn't get on the Supreme Court, but she wrote in a column, you know, I hope President Bush doesn't have any more office wives in the White House. And GQ magazine used the phrase. So it's used a bit differently, but it's an echo from the past. And it's demoralizing in a slightly different way, but it's still demoralizing.
Yeah, like in the 60s, I can recall men referring to their secretaries by saying, "I'll have my girl call your girl."
Oh, yes.
You know, the secretary was his girl, as though A, she was a child, and B, he owned her.
Right.
The more things change. Are they ever depicting anything outside of an office environment? Were women depicted, like, say, in nursing, in a hospital, or in any of the other few, you know, quote-unquote traditional jobs, school teaching for women during this time period in the... Or were they always depicted at the typewriter or some other piece of office equipment?
Yes, they were depicted. There were more. I found more depictions of secretaries actually
than anything else.
Right, but certainly there were nurses, and there were teachers, and those tended to be one of the patterns I found was what I call the expert woman. So, women in those jobs that were really professional jobs, but they were professional jobs that women did, nursing and teaching. They were often portrayed as kind of giving women instructions in how to be good housewives. So one of the ads I found was for bathtub cleaner, and it had this nurse. And it says, a nurse meets all sorts of bathtubs. So that what, I mean, it's hard work and hard training to be a nurse. You know, I couldn't do it. I admire, you know, I mean, it's
so much more to it than emptying bedpans.
That so goes without saying. I mean that
you have to know biology, chemistry. You have to study
medicine, chemistry. I mean, yes, absolutely. So it would depict, you know, professional women in jobs that were professional jobs for women as being sort of authorities on housework. So it showed this nurse sort of cleaning a bathtub, and it was, you know, very infuriating.
Kind of demeaning. Of course, I suppose she had to be on her knees in order to scrub the tub. I don't know.
She was sort of bent over. Actually, the picture's in the book. there was another one with a teacher where there's this mother whose little girl is kind of listless and not eating well. And so she goes in to see the teacher, who says, oh, well, she's constipated. And so, you know, it's sort of, you know, that would be a better question for the nurse. But so this teacher then tells the mother, you know, kind of, you know, if you would just feed her this for breakfast, she wouldn't be constipated. So, yes.
Well.
So it was very, very frustrating.
It's a shame we can't have daddy concerned with that same kind of thing. After all, the little girl is his child, too.
Right.
It's really fascinating. And the picture on the cover is a secretary sitting down at her typewriter with an old-timey telephone right next to her, and the boss looming over her with his business suit on, kind of a scowl on his face.
The businessmen were always scowling.
Yes. So serious. Business Girls and Two Job Wives, Emerging Media Stereotypes of Employed Women by Dr. Jane Marcellus, and it's available on Amazon.com?
It is. It is.
Okay, great. And the publisher is Hampton Press out of Creskill, New Jersey.
Right.
Thank you, Jane, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.